The Gospel of the Lord according to Luke. He said to his disciples, "Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse nor barn, and yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your span of life? If then you are not able to do a small thing like that, why do you worry about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon, in all his glory, was not clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And do not keep striving for what you are to eat and what you are to drink, and do not keep worrying. For it is the nations of the world that strive after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, strive for his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well. Do not be afraid, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." This is the word of the Lord.
I am thankful for a very, very good gathering, and to all those who have made it that way, to the planning committee, to the EP leadership, especially Brent and Reagan, to the plenary speakers, the workshop leaders, the film fest, Joe's roaring proclamation, some said it thundered, to David and his worship crafting, to fellow preachers and brothers and sisters. Thank you. A sports writer was interviewing Yogi Berra one time about one of his players who was having a sensational season, and the sports writer asked Yogi, "Would you say he exceeded your expectation?" And Yogi said, "Well, I'd say he did more than that." So I had great expectations for this gathering, and it did more than that. Would you please pray with me? Through the words that are spoken, O God, and through the stirrings of your Spirit in our thoughts and hearts, remind us of your love and power, that we may yet again today commend ourselves into your hands. Amen. Tom Long was in the audience for the final performance of a production of the Cotton Patch Gospel. It being the last night, he said the cast was especially frisky, and it came the part of the play where Tom Key, who was portraying Jesus, stood on stage and pointed dramatically to the back wall and said, "Look at the lilies of the field." He paused, as if he had forgotten the next line, and said again, "Look at the lilies of the field." Stopped again, and said a third time, "Look at the lilies of the field." Tom Long said by this time everyone was shifting uncomfortably in their seats. I mean, Jesus having a memory lapse. And then Tom Key turned around to the other cast members, shrugged his shoulders, and said, "I can't get them to look." And Long said, "We laughed with relief, but we also laughed with the awareness that he was talking about us." And so when he said the next time, look at the lilies of the field, every head in the auditorium turned to look at the blank auditorium wall. Well, at the close of this gathering, as we worship and prepare to return to, as the phrase goes, our fields of service, I think it's worth considering that as possible parable. How easy it is to sit in the audience, of how easy it is to hear the script, how easy it is to agree with the script, and do nothing. Listen to the animals, Job says. Consider the birds and flowers, Jesus said. Words from a stage that we hear, but not really. I can't get them to look. Why is that? There's what Neil Postman calls the information-action ratio. And he says that because most of our daily news that we receive is inert, consisting of information that gives us something to talk about, but that we can't really respond to in a meaningful way, we have become habituated, he says, to a low information-action ratio. There's the inherent danger that comes with affluence and comfort and security. A lady once came up to Clarence Jordan and asked if she could give her sizable bank account to Koinonia and move into the community to become a part. And Jordan says, please come be a part of us if you feel so led, but give your money, to your sizable big bucks, to someone else. And when she asked why, he said, if you give that much money to Koinonia, we'll stop planting peanuts and start discussing theology. Well, I'm a lot better at discussing than I am at planting. And I'm glad in the Lucan passage Jesus says, uses another word than the one in the Matthew passage, which is the gospel that the Cotton Patch Gospel is based on. In Matthew's gospel, it's the literal look at. In Luke's telling, he uses a word that's a little broader connotations. It can be notice, contemplate, look at with the eyes of the Spirit, one translation is. One morning several weeks ago, I was sitting outside early one morning, and a little bit later, Jane, my wife, came outside, and the first thing she said when she opened the back door is, the iris is blooming. Something to which I had been completely oblivious because I was reading a Wendell Berry essay in the backyard. Consider the ravens and the lilies. If you're so addicted to print that you can't look at, maybe there's still hope for us who are so addicted. So all of these things are at work that shape the lens, the filters, the grids that we have brought with us here to this gathering. But I think there's more going on. I look back on my theological study and formation, and I'm struck by how much the contrast was made between history and nature. Fertility religion stuck in those endless cycles of the natural order, and as somehow biblical religion was linear and to bring us out of, and God's revelation was made in history and to break us out of those kinds of eternal return situations. Added to that was the sense of journey. A wandering Aramean was my father at the beginning of the story. Leave your nets, come follow me. We are strangers and exiles. Somehow, in my mind, that translated into spatial terms. You keep moving. That's the faithful thing to do. History is linear. Nature is cyclical. One is bad and the other is good. I can't help but wonder if that's still there somehow, not as a carefully articulated theology, but just sort of in the mix, the general mess of imprecision of feelings, is the way the poet Eliot says. It's there, and I can't help but wonder if that might be at least part of the play that Professor Wiersbe was wondering about, why the dearth of doctoral students in creation. By the way, that was one of the biggest ahas the huge ahas in coming across Wendell Berry when he said that the dominant tendency in American history is the explorer, discoverer, conquistador. The less dominant, but still another tendency in American history were the settlers, those who would say, we have come this far, we're staying put, which made them the ones who began raising the questions of our relationship to the land. He went on to say how he drew the wheel of life, and he talked about it with great affection and reverence. Alfred Howard, from whom he learned much, of the wheel of life being birth, growth, maturity, death, and decay. And then Hal Berry says how the wheel of life became replaced by the machine as the governing cultural metaphor. Or else we did the change the wheel of life from a natural kind of understanding to a mechanical one, so that the wheel of life was no longer revolving to dwell, but now revolving down this road of progress toward an ever receding horizon. And what that did was weaken the ties of what he calls return to agricultural discipline, which means a couple of things. Now, every natural resource, so to speak, is an ore to be mined, because there's not the return part of the wheel of life. And when it comes to energy, it is a matter then of fuel that goes in and waste that comes out, which works great if there's only two parts of your economy, production and consumption, but it leaves out the return part, the interchangeable, inextricably bound together, where we live into each other's deaths and die into each other's life. How does that, given all those filters and grids and lenses, how do we hear Jesus' words? In my mind, I often compare, trying to put it into context, the things we have heard this weekend with trying to imagine what it was like to those who were hearing about the possible catastrophe of the exile, those who were speaking words of warning, those who were speaking words of anguish, and those who were working so hard to say it just can't possibly happen. I sometimes get embarrassed by how frequently I return to Walter Brueggemann, but the way he talks about this, these matters are so foundational for me. He says, as you all know, imperial economics lead to, or they keep people satiated so we don't notice what's going on, which leads people to numbness, especially numbness about death. And the task of the prophetic ministry, the prophetic imagination, is to nurture and evoke another kind of consciousness, another kind of perception than that of the dominant culture around us. You know all of that. What he goes on to say, though, is that this characteristic idiom is anguish and not anger. Earlier this week, I was talking with a person back home, a wonderful man who is the director of the crisis ministry and the cooperative ministries in our area. Told him where I was coming, and he said, I love my church. He's involved in a very vibrant Presbyterian congregation. He said, but the Sundays I like to miss the most are the Sundays the Creation Care ministry team are leading. He didn't use these words, but the more we talked, it sounded like that very crude but accurate four-word synopsis of all moralistic teaching and preaching. You suck. Try harder. All anger and no anguish. There is a place for anger. Richard Lisher has done a lot of study and attention to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and he said toward the last years of his life, Dr. King surrendered to prophetic rage. The sermon he was scheduled to preach the Sunday after his assassination, and would have preached had it not been for the assassination, was entitled, Why America May Go to Hell. There is a place for anger, but it is anger that comes out of anguish. Abraham Lincoln responded to one of his critics. The last line in his letter was, What I deal in is too vast for malice. So the way a prophet cuts through the numbness and penetrates self-deception is through the language of grief. The prophet enters into the pain of God, the anguish of God, hoping that the ache of God will pierce the numbness of history. I wonder if that pain, that anguish, has penetrated our thoughts this weekend. Have we heard this as another piece of information that we will receive and file away? Thank you very much. And what Jesus says about the birds and the flowers is inextricably intertwined with greed and anxiety and addiction to belongings. And notice that in Luke, Jesus says the ravens, not the birds, as in Matthew's gospel. Unclean birds that were forbidden as food, who themselves now are not those who are our teachers to whom we look, but become a part of the miracle feeding as of the prophet, agents of God's care and provision. The wonder of God's care and provision, even in the midst of us going on to sing the songs of Zion when we can be gorging ourselves on the flesh pots of Egypt. God help me, after all these years, I still hardly know the difference between my coal ash from a hole in the ground. That's the gift of grief and anguish that is a gift that can come with the startling realization that Jesus means and is talking to us. But empire not only leads to numbness, but despair, hopelessness. And so prophetic ministry not only tries to penetrate that with the language of grief, but tries to penetrate that with the language of amazement. Of what God has done, of what God is doing, of what God will do. I was struck by drawing our attention to Galatians 1. And you who were once estranged and hostile in mind, he has now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death, so as to present you holy and blameless and irreproachable before him, provided that you can continue steadfastly established in the faith without shifting from the hope promised by the gospel that you have heard, which has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven. Every creature under heaven. And we were challenged to preach to the animals, to preach to the plants. The size of my congregation has just grown immeasurably. The language of amazement. Have you ever wondered what will happen sometimes? If we don't do this, this will happen. What things will look like when they do happen? I think about Karl Barth going back in 1946 to Bonn, Germany. What had been proclaimed as the unthinkable had in fact happened. He went back to speak at the place where he had taught before he had been deported. The lectures began at 7 a.m. and continued until the big demolition crane started up at 8 o'clock right outside the window to try to continue cleaning up the rubble and the ruins. So literally he was speaking from the ruins of the unthinkable that had already happened. For the first time in his life, Barth said that he talked without a script. He said, with their grave faces looking up at me, which still had to learn to smile again, it was absolutely necessary for me to talk instead of to read. And so he said, I talked as a Sunday school teacher or a missionary or a popular orator or a philanthropist, like a teacher in the youngest Sunday school class. And he talked about the Apostles' Creed. And that part of the Apostles' Creed that he talked about the coming of Jesus Christ the Judge. He talked about the verb tenses of our faith. The Christian perfect is not an imperfect, but rightly understood, it has the force of the future. My times are in your hands. And he said this, so we wander like Elijah in the strength of this food. There are those ravens again. 40 days and 40 nights to the Mount of God, which is called Horeb. It's still wandering. It's still not the goal, but it's wandering directed by the goal. And then he said this. This is how we Christians should speak to non-Christians. We must not sit among them like melancholy owls, but in a certainty about our goal. We look to the birds of the air and their songs. Well, here we sit. At the beginning, Reagan asked us that his goal and his hope was that we leave with renewed energy for the possibilities of creating communities and resilience and restoration. And you can see the fork in the road there. Is the way we understand renewed energy in terms of fuel that we receive, which leaves waste, and our resources here is those to be oared and then placed aside? Or is renewed energy including the indispensable practice of return to where there is no waste, but the wheel of life. To return to the place where God has called you, to the people to whom God has called. Isn't it fascinating that Jesus says, seek the kingdom? And then he says, my little flock, it's God's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Seeking what we have already been given. And maybe, just maybe, when we do that, the realization comes that amid all the words, all the script, Jesus is talking to us. And we turn and follow him to our deep healing and to the glory of God. Amen.